From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember a singer who was loved for her interpretations of opera and American popular song. Eileen Farrell died Saturday at the age of 82. We'll listen back to a 1992 interview with her. Also reporting on the sex lives and big business of racehorses who retired to stud. We talk with Kevin Conley, author of the new book, Stud, Adventures in Breeding. He's an editor at The New Yorker. And linguist Jeff Nunberg remarks on how corporate America is appropriating the language of action-adventure films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Families of victims will be allowed to hear the cockpit recordings from United Airlines Flight 93, which crashed in Pennsylvania on September 11th. NPR's Barbara Bradley has more.
Flight 93 has become famous for the cell phone conversations that took place just before the plane crashed. It had flown west out of Newark, New Jersey, then turned mid-flight and was heading back to Washington. Apparently, when the passengers realized that the plane was being hijacked, some of them rushed the hijackers after one passenger said, "Let's roll." According to an FBI official, some of the families of the victims wanted to hear the cockpit recorder for themselves and hear what happened after the passengers took action. The National Transportation Safety Board, which investigates accidents, has never allowed relatives to listen to the cockpit recordings. The families appealed to the FBI, and Director Robert Mueller himself approved the unusual request. There will be a private listening session in Princeton, New Jersey next month. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Undercover inspectors were reportedly able to smuggle weapons and fake explosives through security at many airports between November and last month. USA Today quotes a confidential memo from the Transportation Department's Inspector General as saying that screeners at 32 airports failed to detect weapons or explosives during the tests. The memo said investigators were able to smuggle knives past the screeners in more than 70% of their attempts. The screeners missed simulated explosives 60% of the time and failed to find guns in 30% of the tests. The tests were done before the Transportation Security Administration took over airport security in mid-February. President Bush is calling on Arab nations to embrace a Saudi peace plan for the Middle East. The White House is also urging the Israeli government to allow Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to attend the Arab summit this week in Beirut. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says the president feels the plan, which was proposed by Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah, would be very helpful in the search for peace. The White House believes Arafat could be an advocate for the concepts in the plan if he is able to participate in the summit.
The president thinks that the summit should devote its energies to focusing on how to bring peace to the region and not discuss who is in or who is not in attendance.
The Saudi plan offers Israel peace with the Arab nations and normal relations in exchange for a full Israeli withdrawal from Arab lands and creation of a Palestinian state with its capital in Jerusalem. But some militant Islamic groups are urging Arab nations to reject the Saudi proposal. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 146 points, just over 1%, to close at 10,281 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 38 points to close at 1,812. The S&P 500 lost 16. This is NPR News. A federal grand jury has indicted a former New York City policeman on new charges in connection with the 1997 attack on a Haitian immigrant. Charles Schwarz was released on bail earlier this month after an appeals court threw out his conviction on civil rights charges in the case of Abner Louima, who was tortured by another officer in a police station bathroom. Schwarz is to be retried on the civil rights charges, but the grand jury has added two new counts of perjury stemming from statements he made during a trial in 2000. The Catholic Archdiocese in Milwaukee says it will investigate allegations that a half-dozen priests had sexual relations with minors. Chuck Quernbach reports from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Milwaukee Archdiocese says the six men have alleged or confirmed records of past sexual misconduct with minors. The priests continue to have contact with the public. but the Catholic Church is setting up a task force of people from outside the Archdiocese who will review the priest's personnel files. Archdiocese spokesperson Jerry Topchewski says the committee will double-check what licensed therapists have recommended to the church.
Let's make sure we're doing things correctly and not erring in any way. Let's make sure we have an additional check and balance in place.
But a Wisconsin advocate for children who have been sexually abused says if the archdiocese knows who the priests are, the church should remove them from the priesthood. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
A spring storm left more than 7 inches of snow and sleet on parts of Nebraska last night, icing the roads and runways. The storm also hit eastern Colorado, Kansas, and Iowa. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember the horse in The Godfather? The horse whose amputated head winds up in bed as a little wake-up call to his owner? That horse was supposed to be a good investment.
Hey, come on over here with me. I want to show you something really beautiful. You do appreciate beauty, don't you? There you are, $600,000 on four hooks. I'll bet Russian Tsars never paid that kind of dough for a single horse. Khartoum. Khartoum. I'm not going to race him, though. I'm going to put him out to stud.
Well, he knew something that we're going to learn more about today. A good stud can earn a fortune. And what a way to earn a living. As my guest Kevin Conley writes, the money is phenomenal, the sex is brisk and multifarious, and the settings are as green and unembarrassed as Eden. Conley is the author of the new book, Stud, which is all about the breeding of racehorses, from the intimate acts to the big business. Conley is an editor at The New Yorker. When he was researching his book, Stormcat was the top stud.
Stormcat, the top stud in 99 and 2000, was making, at the time I began this story, $300,000 for a date, and it's currently up to $500,000 this year, which means at a conservative estimate of 50 such dates a year, he's making $20 million a year. That's not counting the contracts that he has on the side, the long-term contracts with the farm that he has to honor, and various outside farms who realized early on that this was something worth getting in on.
Who would have suspected that sex could be quite that lucrative? How many offspring has Stormcat sired?
I'm not sure what the count is up to because this is foaling season, but mm-hmm. I think last year it was somewhere around 720. And he's very valuable because of those 720, 93 have become stakes winners. Thoroughbred races are graded, and the top echelon of race is a stakes race. And those stakes race winners are very rare, and he sired 93.
Do you think if you sire that many horses that they'd become less valuable because there's so many of them?
Well, the value that Stormcat can give is not necessarily at the racetrack. This is kind of hard to grasp. You pay $500,000 really for the chance to turn around in another year and a half, 2 years, and sell him at a yearling, sell that foal at a yearling sale. And last year, Stormcat's foals, yearlings, sold for an average of $1.7 million. And that, I believe, was on a $250,000 or $300,000 investment. So people turned right around and made $1 million and change on their $300,000, $250,000 investment. And that's really why he's valuable. Now, people who want to get into the horse racing game know that Stormcat is the horse to go to if you want to get a real runner. So there are rich people lining up to get into the thoroughbred racing game. And that's another reason why it's valuable.
Well, why is a stud considered to be worth that much? I mean, I'm thinking that the performance of a horse probably has a lot to do with that horse's temperament as well as its genetics. Maybe the temperament is part of the genetics, but like for human beings, we think that the makeup of a human being is part genetic, but part a function of environment and chance. Wouldn't that be true for horses too?
Absolutely. That's the argument against cloning. If you were to clone five secretariats, who knows how many would make it to the track. One might run into a fence and the other might have lead paint fall down into its feed bowl. And there's, of course, it's just like humans that winning at the races is not necessarily a matter of breeding the fastest horse. For a horse, the race is itself a social event, and they're paying attention to a lot of back and forth nonverbal signals about dominance and submission all the way through the race. Sometimes the race is won before the horses even get in the gate. And so breeding the horse to have that qualities is not just choosing the fastest mare and the fastest filly. You often are breeding for intangibles like temperament and aggressiveness, patience and intelligence, ability to avoid problems.
Does it matter to a horse in terms of its breeding and its ability to race whether it was born through artificial insemination or through an act of actual congress?
Yes. You can't be a thoroughbred unless you've been born by an act of sexual congress. All other breeds use artificial insemination. It's very helpful. It means that you can take a horse in Ohio and impregnate a mare in California or Vancouver. And what this does with thoroughbreds is this prohibition against artificial insemination means that the mares have to travel to where the stallions are. And in this country, the stallions, the highest concentration of stallions, the most valuable studs in the world, are all in about a 60-mile radius, centered around Lexington, Kentucky. That's where Stormcat was, is. That's where Seattle Slough is. That's where this year's Horse of the Year point, a point given, has retired. I would bet that 90% of the horses in the top 100 are in Kentucky.
I know that you've been to the places where the breeding takes place. Would you describe one of those places for us?
Well, they all look as beautiful as any English boarding school. At the top of the line farms, they have a colonnade of trees, beautiful Irish stone fences, slate roofs, oak barns. When you get to, say, Coolmore, Ashford Stud in Kentucky, even the hay seems to be art directed. There's so much money in the business that they're selling you the dream as well as the barnyard experience.
What happens when it's time for the mare and the stud to perform the act of congress? How are they like introduced? How do they get together?
Well, before the mare and this stallion, the valuable stallion, are introduced, there's a teaser stallion who has to come in and do his job. Now, the teaser stallion is there because the actual stallion is much too valuable to get kicked by a mare who isn't quite in the mood yet. So they bring some horse who hasn't been quite as good at the track. The stallions have these noble names like Stormcat or Dynaformer or Conquistador Cielo or Seattle Slough. And the teaser stallions have gas station-type names, you know, Earl and Honcho and Coop and Skitchy. And they'll bring old Coop in, and he'll try a jump. Often he wears a leather apron and something of the sort to make sure that he doesn't get too intimate with the mare. But when it's clear to everyone in the barn that the mayor is not about to kick the prize horse flesh, who's probably waiting in the wings at this point. The poor teaser stallion is hauled off to get frustrated again tomorrow or maybe later in the afternoon. And the stallion steps in. The stallion pretty much believes that everything that walks through the breeding shed door is his. And by this point, he's heard some of the goings on, and he is ready to go, usually, if he's a professional with a high libido. And he, depending on his personality, different horses are different. Seattle Slough seemed to be very gentlemanly in his address of the mare, cautious to make sure that the teaser stallion had done his job correctly. He seemed to come up along the side and gently nuzzle her down her flanks and then take a tentative jump himself on his own. And, of course, all of this is going on in the presence of six or more professionals who choreograph the event for efficiency, speed. There is a man or woman holding the mare's lead shank, somebody holding the stallion's lead shank. There's what's called a tail man who will pull the mare's tail back at the last minute. There is a stallion manager ready to guide the stallion home when he rears. And there are, of course, usually a vet or several other grooms in attendance in case they're needed. Some stallions are a little bit more leisurely about the act, and sometimes somebody will come from behind and kind of give him an extra push if he seems to be a little slow at his job. It's really, in its own way, a little like the New York City Ballet, very highly choreographed. And when it's done well, which it almost always is, it takes about 30 seconds, probably about an eighth of the time it's taken me to describe it.
Does there have to be any chemistry between the mare and the stallion?
Well, it's funny because there are definitely some stallions who have their preferences. The Seattle Slough seem to like gray mares, I was told. And when I went to visit a feral herd, which was a group of about 60 horses who had arranged themselves into different harems, each of the stallions, the harem stallions, seemed to have chosen according to his own preference. There was a stallion they called Hershey who seemed to prefer kind of chocolatey brown horses. There was another one who liked the kind of paint variety with dapple colors. And so, yes, they have their preferences, and they have their preferences often, and their moods, but they... The professionals in the breeding shed will make sure the job is done. Sometimes it will take 40 minutes, and generally it's pretty quick.
Does it seem like the mare or the stallion get any pleasure out of the act?
It's hard to know exactly.
I feel like such a voyeur talking about the horses doing this. it's odd to talk about.
It is very odd to talk about it, and when I first went down, I felt strange in actually being there, but everybody there was so comfortable. This is, you have to remember, million-dollar properties being created. This is a business, and mm-hmm. these are people whose job is to make sure that it's done well. And actually, I was more embarrassed about my embarrassment in the end than anything else.
So do the horses get any pleasure out of it?
Certainly the stallions seem to enjoy it. The mares seem to have a drive to reproduce that is quite strong. Most of the time, they could care less about the stallion. Pretty much 11 months of the year and 27 days. But during those 3 days or so of estrus, they couldn't be more come hither in their behavior.
My guest is Kevin Conley, author of the new book, Stud. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kevin Conley, author of the new book, Stud, Adventures in Breeding. He's an editor at The New Yorker. How do the owners know when the horse is going to be, when the mare is going to be ovulating?
Well, that's one of the reasons why in the past 30 years or so, this business has become so much more lucrative than it used to be. For much of this century, stallion could only manage about 40 or so dates a year. But with a lot of the increase in veterinary, the accuracy of pinpointing the ovulation in that veterinarians can do, they've been able to know exactly when the mare is ovulating and hustle her right over to the breeding shed. So they've been able to double, triple, even quadruple in some cases, that 40 a year. Last year's leading stud, Thunder Gulch, I believe, had 216 dates. Live covers, they call it in Kentucky.
And will the mare almost definitely get pregnant?
I think the standard is 60% conception rate.
Do you have to pay if your mare doesn't get pregnant? Do you still have to pay the full
fee? Most of the contracts, and there are definitely a variety of contracts. Most of the contracts are for a guaranteed live foal, which means they will give you another chance until you get pregnant, and you will pay the stud fee on the delivery of an animal four legs on the ground.
Right. Meanwhile, let's back up a second. What happens to the teaser stallion who's brought out to arouse the mare? Then the stallion's led away in frustration. Then what?
You know, I have to say that I really identified with the teaser stallions through it. They seem to have a lot of personality. And you know, I was, in my own life, I was more the guy who sat around and made the jokes and then went off to get a drink for somebody. And meanwhile, the moody and attractive man had left with the person I'd been talking with. And so the role of teaser stallions, I always wanted to follow them and find out what they do. They pretty much have a life that's filled with frustration. But when I visited the feral herd, I spoke with the woman who runs that research center, and she was actually a therapist for the dysfunctional stallion and used this feral herd as a kind of laboratory for the psychological health of the stallion. The stallion in the wild is always potent, always fertile, always healthy. And it's in the thoroughbred breeding farms that you find these strange problems. And one of the things that she told me was that as soon as a stallion gains access to the mare, his testosterone level skyrockets. And as soon as he's taken away, within hours, his testosterone level drops. And teaser stallions often spend the most time around the mares. They spend a lot of their day going around the broodmare barns, checking to see if the mares who live there are ready to ovulate, kind of giving a preliminary check. And so, strangely, it's the teaser stallions often who have the highest testosterone level on the farm. The stallions who usually live in seclusion, by themselves, often in a barn housed at night with the other stallions, but they're kept away from each other. They live like monks on their own because there is a belief that stallions are very aggressive. They are, in fact, very aggressive. And left to their own devices, these stallions would fight to the death.
So the poor teasers get no relief?
They're They very rarely do. The people who work at the barn often work most with the teaser stallion. In other words, the stallions will come and go, but the teaser is there for mare after mare. So that they feel kind of close to the teasers too. So they will make sure often that he gets a little fulfillment at some point. There are there's a strange thing. Many of the things that humans have a kind of analog in the horse world, and thoroughbred mares are often so nervous that they reject their foal, and the farm has to bring in a nurse mare, and kind of like a nanny, to be a wet nurse for the expensive foal. And those nurse mares, contractually, have to be returned to their owner pregnant. And a lot of farms take pity on these teaser stallions, and it's the teasers who do the job of getting the nurse mares pregnant. So there is relief.
Well, here's the question I need to ask. How did all this horse sex affect your libido?
Well, now, I've spoken with a psychiatrist who treats a lot of horsemen down in Lexington, and I've heard that there's a certain jump that they get from being around a particularly prepotent sire, as they say. I can't really admit on national radio to any effect in my own personal life. I do have a four-month-old baby.
So did watching the process of horse breeding affect your interest in horse racing?
Yes. I now pull for the youngins of the sires that I've seen in the breeding shed, definitely. It's very easy to get a kind of rooting participation, just interest in thoroughbred racing because of that.
Well, Kevin Conley, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Kevin Conley is the author of the new book, Stud, Adventures in Breeding. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's the guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, can do. This guy says the horse can do, if he says the horse can do. Can do, can do.
I'm picking Valentine, cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9. But look at FS happy with it by a half, according to this here is a telegraph.
For Paul Revere out fight, I hear his foot's all right, of course it all keeps.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Far Appalachia, Following the New River North by Noah Adams, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember soprano Eileen Farrell. She died Saturday at the age of 82. She sang with the Met, but she also recorded many albums of American popular song. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how corporations are appropriating the language of action and adventure films.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Singer Eileen Farrell died on Saturday at the age of 82. We're going to listen back to an interview with her, recorded in 1992 when she was 72. Farrell was generally acknowledged to be the first opera singer to have a hit pop album. That was her 1960 recording, I've Got a Right to Sing the Blues. But more important, she was considered by many to be the best example of an opera singer who understood what to do with American popular song. Farrell was not only unpretentious as a pop singer, she was known for her unpretentiousness in the world of opera. She sang with the Met for 5 seasons and had a long, successful concert career. Before she was born, her parents had a vaudeville act. They were billed as the Singing O'Farrells. Let's start with one of Eileen Farrell's pop recordings. This is My Foolish Heart.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware, my foolish heart. How white the ever constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart. There's a line between love and fascination that's hard to see. They both give the very same sensation when you're lost in the magic of a kiss.
What are some of the mistakes you think that some opera singers make when they try to sing pop?
Well, I think that, see, most singers, the voice is first with them. They're thinking of their voice all the time. And instead of paying attention to the words, they may be paying attention to the words, but they're also thinking of the voice. The voice is it. Well, I have never, like my teacher always used to say, don't listen to yourself, because if you listen to yourself, you're going to get into trouble. In other words, you'll always hear yourself, but don't listen. Don't concentrate on how you sound, because you're listening to the final effect, what people are going to hear. So therefore, you're concentrating on the wrong thing. You should concentrate on what you have to do as far as your breath is concerned and as far as placing, you know, and I don't mean to use that word placing, but singing forward and using your breath. And if you concentrate on those things, the result is going to be there.
Your new album, It's Over, is one of a series of recent recordings that you've made on the label Reference Recordings.
Yes.
What got you back into doing these kinds of pop songs, you know, recording them?
Oh, well, let me see. 6 years ago, my husband died, and I just got into a real funk, and I didn't want to sing at all. I was very depressed. And Lunis McGlowan, who, as a matter of fact, Lunis and I had a show on...
NPR.
Yes, we did years ago, but we did 12 weeks. And so Lunis kept saying to me, come on, you got to start singing. I said, no, I don't got to. I don't have to do anything I don't want to do at this time of my life. And he said, no, come on, you've got to sing. So... I went down to, Lunis is in North Carolina, so I went down and we started fooling around with the piano and he would pick out a song and I think, oh God, that's so sad, and I'd start to cry and I couldn't sing. So finally, I got a letter from Tam Henderson, who owns Reference Recordings, and just a note saying that he had a small company and he'd been a fan of mine for years and he would like to record me. So I thought, well, what have I got to lose? You know, I don't know if it's going to be good or bad. So I said, okay, we'll do one. So he went down to North Carolina, and I forget the first one we did. I guess it was probably Harold Arlen, because I love him so much. And we started to make these records, and lo and behold, I now have 7, and we're working on the 8th.
Great.
Yeah.
So you said you when you started to sing these songs again, you'd end up crying in the middle of songs.
Oh, honey, I still do.
Really?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, because I love sad songs.
Was it always that way, or did that have something to do with your husband's death?
It was always that way. I mean, my husband's death had a great deal to do with it, of course. But for instance, I could never sing Butterfly. That music in Butterfly just pulverizes me. I just completely go to pieces. And I remember years ago, Eric Leinsdorf said that he wanted me to record Butterfly with him. And I said, I can't. He said, of course you can. I said, no, I cry. He said, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard in my life. So we went into a studio and he started, you know, playing the Butterfly. And we got to such a spot and all I have to hear is the music. I didn't even open my mouth yet. And the tears started. And he says, oh, you've got to stop that. I said, yeah, easy for you.
So what happened?
I didn't do it.
Did you ever start crying during a performance on stage?
No. The nearest thing I have, but I have to keep talking to myself all the time. You know, you can't do this, you can't do that. While I'm singing, I'm talking to myself. It was the Giancarlo Minotti's To This We've Come. That is pretty... That's a pretty tough message. And I have gotten caught up with that a couple of times. I got to the point where I said, well, you know, you just can't do this anymore. So, I mean, I can do the aria, but not get carried away by it.
Well, since you've mentioned it, why don't we hear that aria?
No, speaking of it.
Speaking of it, this is from Giancarlo Minotti's opera, The Consul. And we'll hear you singing the aria To This We've Come with Thomas Schippers conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. Do you remember the making of this recording?
Oh, yes.
Did tears come to your eyes during this?
No, because I tell you, we were in London doing this, and Giancarlo, he came to the recording session. And I was petrified. Here he is sitting there in the studio, and I can see him through the glass, and I'm singing his To This We've Come. And I thought, oh, God, I've got to do this right. And he's listening and listening, and he's so pensive looking. And I thought, oh, my God, I hope it comes out all right. So I was pretty on edge during that recording.
Okay. You're just joining us. My guest is Eileen Farrell. Who got serious about your voice first, your mother or
my
you?
My mother. Your mother. Oh, me. Oh, that's the last thing in the world. I mean, I don't know. When I was in high school, I don't know whatever I thought I was going to be, but I had no ambitions to be anything, really. Nothing. Just to have a good time. And when I graduated from high school, my mother said, we used to get the New York Times every Sunday, and there was an ad singing teacher, and my mother knew her because my mother studied with the same teacher that she did. And so she said, we're going to go down and see if she thinks that, you know, you have a voice. We'll go to New York, because we were living in Rhode Island at that time. So we went to New York, and I was more excited to go to New York. That's a great, you know, that was wonderful. I'd never been there before. So I sang for this woman, and she said, yes, she'd take me. So I went back home, and it was in August. No. Whenever, September, I guess it was, I went back to New York, and I studied with this woman, and I studied with her about 5 years. She didn't do me any harm, but she didn't correct me very much.
What needed correcting?
I don't know. See, because I found out later that I was her first pupil. Very much later. And she would say, well, now that sounds pretty good. You know, and I said, oh, I guess it's okay. But she would give me some, you know, vocalizings to do, and I did that. And then I had never learned German before, and I had to learn German. And I was
learning sight reading, taking those lessons. And then I had to if I was going to stay in New York, which to me I wasn't going to because I had never been away from home this long, and I told my mother I wasn't going to stay, and my mother said, oh, yes, you are. So I had to have a job in order to stay, so I went to CBS to audition to get into the chorus because that's about all I could, you know, do was sing.
This was CBS Radio.
CBS Radio, yes. This is in 1940.
Mm-hmm. So you auditioned to be in the chorus. You ended up with your own radio show, though.
That's right. I was in the chorus for about 3 months, and then they offered me my own radio show, half-hour radio show once a week, and I was there for 7 years.
So what would you sing on your radio show?
It was a half-hour show. I would do one aria and at least one song in either German, French, or Italian. Then the orchestra would do a couple of numbers, and then I would sing something in English. And so, therefore, it depended upon what the timing of the orchestra and my songs. So I did that because it was just a half-hour show. I did that every week for 7 years.
Did you have a theme?
Yes.
What was it?
It was Let My Song Fill Your Heart.
Uh-huh.
Ernest Charles wrote that years ago. It was
how did that go?
Let my song fill your heart with its melody, oh, so divine. And that's about all they ever heard.
And then an announcer came on.
That's
and said,
right.
Eileen Farrell.
Yeah, right. Here she is. Da, 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 da.
And who was your sponsor?
Oh, it was no sponsor.
No sponsor?
No. Oh, no. That was, you know, strictly CBS. In those days, CBS did a tremendous amount of good music because they had the symphony. And they had several shows, I forget what one was called. I was on, and several other people had their own shows, and they were not sponsored at all.
Mm-hmm. No, it was around 1940 that you started your radio show.
Right.
It was about 20 years later, in 1960, that you joined the Met.
Yes.
Can you give me a really quick sense of what happened in between?
Oh, from radio, I did concerts all over the place.
Right.
Concerts. Then I sang with orchestras, you know, doing arias with orchestra. And I did some recordings. And I did quite a few TV things. I did a lot of Gary Moore shows.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of Ed Sullivan shows.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was, I forget when it was that one day the phone rang and it was Mr. Bing. And he said to me, I've read several times that the reason you are not at the Metropolitan is because you have never been asked. And I said, that's true. I never have been asked. So here's, well, I'm asking you. So that's how that started.
We're listening back to a 1992 interview with singer Eileen Farrell. She died Saturday. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Singer Eileen Farrell died Saturday. We're listening back to a 1992 interview with her. You stayed with the Met for 5 seasons.
Yes.
What were the reasons behind your leaving?
Well, the last year I was there, Mr. Bing, offered me 2 performances of Chenier. And then he asked me if I would do Wozzeck in English. And I said, no, I wouldn't do Wozzeck in English. I had done it in German, and I had recorded it in German, and I said, I'm not about to relearn an opera, because I had already done that many years ago with another Strauss opera, Ariadne, and it's very difficult, and I thought at this stage of the game, I'm not going to start doing that. So when I said no to him, I had a feeling that that was it. So the next season, my manager called him to say, you know, what do you have to offer next year? Because we have to plan a concerts around it. And he said, we have nothing to offer her next year unless one of our foreign artists will relinquish a role to her, then she can have it. And I said to him, no thanks. I said to my manager, you tell him no thanks and take my name off the roster. So that's just the way it ended.
Were you very sorry?
Yes, I was. I loved singing opera. I loved it. But of course, I was doing so many other things. But today, when I'm not doing all these things, I think the thing I miss most is the opera, because I loved being on stage and I loved singing with other people. It's a wonderful experience.
Many years ago, the writer Winthrop Sargent
profiled
you in the New Yorker magazine,
yeah.
And that became a chapter in his book Divas.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote about you that, you know, Eileen Farrell had never had the passionate devotion to a career that inspires most divas. She was happier as a housewife. And he also wrote that you distrusted the opera world with all its exotic surroundings. How much of that do you think of as being true?
I think the first part is true. The second part is not true.
That it's true that you didn't have a passionate devotion to your career.
I didn't. I never had a passionate. What is the word? A passionate
devotion
to anything. I don't think. I just look. As long as I was singing, that's all I cared for. I love to sing. That's my big thing. I just love to sing. And whatever I sing, I mean, I don't sing it unless I love to sing it.
You said that part of what Winthrop Sargent said wasn't true. Is that the part about distrusting the opera world?
Yeah. No, that's not true.
Yeah.
No, because I have so many friends that are in the opera world, yeah. And they're wonderful friends.
Listen, of all the Ed Sullivan shows that you've done,
yeah.
Which one really stands out in your mind?
Oh, God. Well, one night he called me Eileen O'Farrell.
Well, that's your original name, right?
No, that was my original name is Eileen Farrell.
But your parents were the singing O'Farrell.
Yeah, I know. They used the O.
Oh, they just used it. I see.
Yeah.
Right.
Because now I found out that O means the son of. since I've been to Ireland 3 times. Oh, it's such a wonderful place. But anyway, to get back to what?
Sullivan.
Oh, yeah. And then, because, you do it in all one day. You get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then you rehearse, and then you have to tape it in the afternoon so he could watch it. And then you do it again at night, and that's live, And so that Sunday is just terrible. So I had rehearsed, and then it came, we taped it for the dress rehearsal. And then after the dress rehearsal, after he heard the tape, he said, I don't like that pop, because I always used to sing an aria and a pop tune.
Uh-huh.
He said, I don't like that tune. And I thought, well, tough, buddy. It's Sunday. So that meant that they had to get the orchestrations down to the theater. And everybody had gone out to get their dinner before 8 o'clock, see? And I'm just sitting there, and I had to find another song that Ed would approve of. So he approved of one, so we passed out all the music, and then I sang that. And he said, yeah, that'll be okay. So then I, try to get my nerves settled down, and then that night I went out, and he introduced me, and I sang the aria, and then he introduced that I was going to sing such and such a song, and it was the song that he didn't want me to sing.
Oh, so what'd you do?
At that point, I didn't know what I was going to sing. I hadn't the slightest idea what that song was that we had changed to. I tell you, that was a moment of really, I could have died. Oh, I could have killed him. I could have killed him. So the orchestra started the introduction, and the Lord was with me, because I recognized from the introduction, and I started to sing, and I sang the whole thing. Well, I had I guess five or six shows to do with him, and I canceled the rest of them. I think I cannot go through this. Life is too short. But he was a very funny man, though, and he didn't know it.
Yeah.
It's true.
So that was your last Sullivan show?
Yeah, sure was.
Wow.
It sure was. But I did a lot before that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Eileen Farrell, it's been just a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
I thank you very much.
Well, I thank you for asking me.
Eileen Farrell, recorded in 1992. She died Saturday at the age of 82. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on how corporations are appropriating the language of action and adventure films. This is Fresh Air. One picturesque note to the Enron affair was the names that the company picked for those offshore corporations that it used to hide its losses. A number of them came from action-adventure films like Braveheart, Jurassic Park, and above all, the Star Wars movies, which contributed names like Jedi Capital, Obi-Wan Holdings, Kenobi Incorporated, and Chuco, after the Chewbacca character. According to our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, those names say something about the way modern corporations think about themselves.
I'll grant you that Enron's use of names like Jedi Capital and Obi-Wan Holdings was a symptom of the singularly space cadet mentality of the company's top management. But that fondness for Star Wars imagery isn't limited to one rogue outfit in Houston. The fact is that George Lucas has probably had more influence on the language of corporate America than any other single individual, with Vince Lombardi and Fritz Perls running neck and neck for second. This has less to do with Lucas's cinematic imagination than with a problem that has haunted corporate America ever since the early 20th century, when large corporations definitively replaced the family firm as a dominant economic force. How do you motivate employees to feel a sense of loyalty or commitment to an abstract entity like a corporation? In the words of Peter Drucker, the first and only great theorist that the corporations ever had, an engineer will not be motivated to make a shareholder rich. That problem became more urgent about 20 years ago as corporations started to bail out on the traditional promise of lifetime employment and as the salary gap between employees and top managers began to swell. That's when corporations and consultants started talking about creating high-performance corporate cultures. That term was meant to suggest that purely symbolic rewards and motivations could move employees to feel a loyalty and esprit de corps that went beyond anything that was justified by material considerations alone. But culture is too vague a term to do any work by itself. It has to be fleshed out with language borrowed from some other realm of social life. Writing just after the Second World War, when the country had come together in a swell of patriotic spirit, Drucker has suggested that corporations ought to think of themselves as miniature polities, the representative institutions of society. But modern corporations haven't found the language of civic engagement a very inspiring model. It's not stirring enough, for one thing, and it focuses too much on individualism and democratic consensus. However you package it, it's hard to make a corporation look like anything but an oligarchy. At first blush, the military would seem to be a better model. But modern military language has become more corporate than the language of the corporation itself, with its predilection for acronyms and euphemisms like collateral damage. And not even a bank or insurance company would dare to refer to its employees as assets. What corporations really wanted their employees to feel like was the combatants in medieval romances, setting out on quests in the face of implacable, inhuman enemies and driven by a spiritual sense of mission. And of course, that's what the space operas made their stock in trade, Sir Gawain on the holodeck. So it's no accident that shortly after movies like Star Wars, Star Trek, and Mad Max began to appear, corporations started to loot their language. Salespeople became road warriors, and the people who shepherd new products and initiatives through development were called champions. Above all, that was when corporations started to come up with vision statements and mission statements. Those were posted on walls or websites and printed on wallet-sized cards that employees were expected to carry on their persons at all times, like the sacramental badges called scapulars that the members of monastic fraternities wear under their clothing. In the end, these vision statements almost always come down to the same bromides and generalities that have been around for years under the headings of goals and mottos. Our vision is to seek long-term growth by providing innovative, high-quality products that create significant value for our customers. That's an unimpeachable corporate objective, whether you're selling eyeglasses or heavy equipment. But 30 years ago, nobody would have thought to describe it as a vision, a word that used to be reserved for people like St. Teresa of Avila. Whatever you tell them, of course, most corporate employees aren't at risk of confusing themselves with Luke Skywalker. In fact, the chief effect of all that Star Wars talk about missions and visions has been to exacerbate employees' sense of disaffection, all the more because it seems to demean the everyday dedication that most people actually bring to their jobs. In private life, it's enough to have goals and hopes, but when you arrive at the workplace now, your eyes are expected to be glistening with some nobler sense of purpose. I recall what a friend of mine told me about having to compose a vision statement for his job. It isn't enough that I give them my body. Now they want me to kiss them on the mouth. But then the real audience for this language isn't so much the employees it's addressed to as the executives who commission it. In an age when successful CEOs are routinely treated as media stars, top managers no longer model themselves after traditional corporate sages like Alfred Sloan or James Watson. They'd rather think of themselves in the image of General Patton or Captain Kirk, leading their troops into battle as they trail a cloud of rousing metaphors behind them. However dreary or dull your friends may find you, it isn't hard to think of yourself as a charismatic leader when you've got a communications department churning out yards of fulsome panegyric. Not long ago, I saw a Xerox Corporation press release that said, "The senior team spontaneously erupted into sustained applause and stood as a sign of respect to their new leader." That's the sort of language that would make even a Stalinist apparatchik blush. In the end, though, the real victims of this sort of talk aren't the cynical employees who ridicule it. It's the trusting ones who buy into the story and load up their 401ks with the company's stock. And then, when the Death Star explodes, the force is nowhere to be found.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford's Center for the Study of Language and Information. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback by H.W. Brands, The First American, The Life and Times of Benjamin Franklin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with one of the stars of HBO's 6 Feet Under, Michael C. Hall. He plays the gay brother. Also, director Hal Hartley talks about his new movie, No Such Thing, his version of a monster movie. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.